Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The turmoil and division our nation has gone through for many long months has not eased since the election of Donald Trump. Today, civil rights leader, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, is in Ann Arbor, speaking in panels and speaking at a rally on the campus of the University of Michigan, sharing his thoughts on what's ahead for us under President Donald Trump. I had a chance to sit down with Reverend Jackson earlier today. A week ago, we woke up to the news that Donald Trump is our president-elect. How would you describe where we are this day, a week later?
There are two issues that stand out in my mind. One is that Hillary Clinton had the most votes, he had the fewest votes. The one person, one vote democracy, she's the winner. In a democracy where the vote of the common people is diminished and that a group of overseers determine the winner, it's a different outcome. So it raises the question, really, are a one-person, one-vote democracy or an aristocracy, which is a struggle for the soul of America. December 19th, when the electors vote, Hillary Clinton will have had 2 million plus more votes, and that's a big day in American history.
What has that led in this country when I think that, you know, since the election, across the country, we've seen a real burst of hate incidents. Here in Ann Arbor, a student at the University of Michigan reports she was threatened by a man who said, I'll light you on fire if you don't remove your hijab. What has this election opened up in this country?
There are two issues. One issue is the count of the vote. Mm-hmm. Issue is the character of the campaign. The character of the campaign was to exacerbate fears rather than to create hope or to expand hope. The threat to Mexican Americans. I've taught with Mexican American children crying, fear their parents will be in the 15 million deported, for example. Ban on Muslims. We ran a campaign on that basis of chasing down the birthplace of President Barack Obama, saying that women who fight for right of self-determination, that if they want to have an abortion, it's back to states' rights again. They're going to challenge Roe v. Wade. These threats have created tremendous fear. So these student demonstrations and street demonstrations are born of fear. And the man who set the field afire has a responsibility to wipe it out.
But speaking of fear, as we heard very clearly, there are legions of voters who feel afraid for their futures. Their savings have been wiped out. Their pay has been cut. Jobs are gone. Some of their towns have been hit hard. And those, they say, are their primary concerns and why they voted for Mr. Trump. And they say they resent being called racist and misogynist and xenophobic. How do you respond to those
fears?
The
economic consternation is real. The scapegoating is wrong. That's why Bernie Sanders and Trump had the same appeal to that group of people. Guns in, drugs in, jobs out. We globalized capital without globalizing human rights and workers' rights. And so Trump looks through a keyhole and sees the dry field and lights a match. Bernie Sanders and Hillary look at that same field and put water to grow to make the grass green. So do you green that field or do you say it's a zero-sum game and set it on fire? And so people have been led to vote for Trump. You have to excuse the anti-feelings toward Muslims and African-Americans and Latinos and women. That's a lot to jump over just to vote.
You have seen so much in your lifetime as a civil rights activist and leader, going back to Jim Crow and marching alongside Martin Luther King. In what ways do you see what's happening right now, post-election, as a continuation of our long history of racism in America?
Well, there are two things happening. The first thing is that there is a great struggle over the integrity of the voting process. Mm. Whether the winner loses and the loser wins, that is a legitimate fight to make our democracy as it says it is on paper, all won by the people, one person, one vote. Mm. On the other hand, that some of the wounds created and some of the fears that came in the process of campaigning will not go away easily. I mean, looking at children crying for fear and parents being deported, the Muslim children threatened, hijab snatched from their heads. That's just wrong. And the one who set the fire, Mr. Trump has most obligation to put the fire out. And then you add to that fire the fuel of taking white nationalism to the highest level of our government. That's more fuel. That's not more water.
Looking at the numbers from the election, just in the city of Detroit, which is, of course, a majority African-American city, Hillary Clinton got nearly 50,000 fewer votes than President Obama did in 2012, and turnout was lower as well. What do you think did the Clinton campaign miss or not do enough of to be attractive to more black voters?
Well, first of all, the most voters she got were black, point one. Point two, President Barack was an extraordinary candidate, a historical candidate with charisma and substance. We did not lose Michigan because of Detroit. The auto workers whose jobs had gone abroad got bailed out by the Democrats that ignored their deliverance. 8 years ago, we lost 800,000 jobs in 1 month. All the industry was virtually gone. Now it's back again. And many people did not vote the interest. In the same time, in the city of Detroit, 100,000 vacant homes and abandoned lots. If you just remove the lead paint jobs, if you cut the grass and the weeds, landscapers' jobs, if you demolish the houses that cannot stand, jobs, if you put windows without boards, jobs. So there appears to be no urban plan for reconstruction. Many people who had hope 7 years ago don't have the same hope today. They may not vote the same way today they voted 8 years ago.
What do you think the Democratic Party needs to do now?
To fight for the suppressed vote. If the suppressed vote had counted, it would be a different discussion today. Even though the federal government intervened in North Carolina to stop what they call surgical precision of voter discrimination, the North Carolina Republican leader brags about driving the black vote down 8.5 and the white vote up 22% by removing 400 precincts, by removing votes from campuses, for example. So if Democrats fight vigorously for the suppressed black vote, that's the key to victory. It's the margin by which Kennedy won in 1960. It's the margin by which Clinton won in 92 and 96. So the suppressed black vote is one outcome. The freed black vote is another.
When you think of what we've seen through the campaign and now since the election, the kinds of things I refer to, the hate signs left at churches and threatening words and gestures to racial and religious minorities, how do you think we keep this from becoming the new normal in America?
Well, the one who lit the fire must know you cannot govern under these conditions. You're going to create a nation that is vigorously divided and driven by the incitement of fear rather than the excitement of hope. I would only hope that Mr. Trump will govern differently than the campaign.
In the way we talk to each other as Americans, you look at social media, you look at comments following news stories.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
You raised a question about the people who voted for Trump and not being called racist. When you look at a candidate who espouses, quote-unquote, Jewish money and banned the Muslims, and a wall with Mexicans. If you look at all that racism and vote in spite of that, you're on that team. You're on the racist team. And you cannot somehow expect to be excused for that relationship.
Fair point. So I want to talk about how we talk with each other in this now divided country. And it's very clear. You see comments on social media saying, I don't want to hear, I don't want to know why you voted for, fill in the blank. What can concerned people do, citizens, to help our nation heal, whether they voted for Clinton?
Don't use the economic crisis as an excuse for racist behavior. Or don't call racism conservatism. The idea of racial fears and racial sanctuaries is not good for the human being. We've survived apart. We must learn to live together as brothers and sisters in love. When Michigan plays the big game on Saturday afternoon, it's uniform color, not skin color. It's direction, not complexion. If we accept each other to fulfill our emotions and our joys as gladiators on that football field, we must see them as human beings on Monday morning in class and on the job. We've learned to play ball together. We've learned to fight wars together. We've not learned to live together. We must consciously work on learning to love and to live and to share.
When you think of the young people all around us on this campus, young people you'll be speaking with, they're the ones who are going to pick up the torch. What do you see as their greatest challenge?
There's a big rally today on this campus and 70 others around the country. I'm speaking at the rally here today because in this university space, who's their classmate, their roommate, their hallmate may be of different religions. They must affirm ecumenical, multi-religious, affirm multicultural living, and learn it. They may have come from isolated spaces. They must learn on this campus to live in a civilized, humane way. They must learn to see the world through a door, not through a keyhole. They must learn that lesson and build a sense of internal strength and character.
What are your biggest fears for this generation as they go forth?
The biggest fear is that we would go backwards into fear rather than forward into hope. That we go backwards into polarization rather than forward into unity. We've made an awful lot of progress in 50 years. That progress is now threatened by this environment. I've seen football coaches take one position and their players another. I mean, at that level. I saw Coach Popovich from the San Antonio Spurs make a strong case last week for how uncivilized it is to teach children not to violate people based on race and religion, and how we voted for that. To that extent, it's a kind of shameful day for the country. There's no guarantee we're going to build up economically. But the evidence is we're worse off socially today and morally.
And finally, as you go around the country and especially meeting young people like you are on the campus, what are your hopes for this new generation as they prepare to take over?
That we'll become more active participants in our own political process. That we'll become less violent and more caring. With all of the achievements academically, people want to care that you know I'm at the University of Michigan, but they want to know that you care. I'm a human being, and that matters.
Reverend Jesse Jackson, thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.